we are overloaded with information. And there's such a tendency to look at technology, to look at the filters we have set up on Facebook, to look at the lists we have created for ourselves on Twitter, to even look at who we trust to go for information person to person. We are looking for that trust.
I'm Alex Blumberg, host of the podcast Startup, and you're listening to We Are LA Tech.
Hi, everyone. My name is Brian Nickerson. I'm guest hosting on We Are LA Tech for Esprit Devora. I'm delighted to have our guest today, Jen Hirsch. She's a global technology trend scout at EY and a longtime friend and just an innovator in the space. So really excited to have you on the show. Welcome, Jen.
Thanks, Brian. And for those out there, EY is formerly known as Ernst & Young. Sometimes those in the startup world hasn't yet made the branding there.
And Ernst & EY is a pretty big company.
Yeah, 250,000 people globally. You can go to any major city in the world and look up and see the big yellow swoosh and lettering of EY on most buildings, which is pretty cool to think about.
Yeah, amazing. Swoosh like Nike swoosh? Or
yeah, a little bit. It's like a dash. I do a hand motion. You can't see.
So how does one become global technology trend scout?
You know, I get asked this question a lot because I work with our first through third years at all parts of EY. And I truly have a global role where I talk to New Zealand one day, Thailand the next, and our headquarters in London. Sometimes I talk to them all in one day, which is very complicated. So they ask me all the time, how did I get to be a global technology trend scout? And I say, okay, do this job since you're 17 years old, and then eventually someone's going to pay you for it.
and there was a job posting, right? For global
So the actual story of how I got the job, I think, is pretty funny. I had run a consulting firm for 7 years, helping early stage companies get bought. When I say early stage, I mean Series A and before. And I love that world of 20-person teams and growing rapidly and being part of a very mission-based organization and used to know everyone who works with you. And every day at my new company, I meet someone. So I'd run that for a number of years and I was ready for my next challenge. And I was sitting down over coffee with a friend of mine who's an angel investor. And I say, you know, I think I want to do something globally. Like, I still want to work with startups, but on a global level. And I've always been like a futurist and a trend scout and like kind of want to do that too. And maybe like try out corporate for a while. And he laughs and he goes, you know, why I have coffee with you every 6 months is because you were the person who let me know about Uber. You were the very first person who ever told me about it. So I come to you every few months just to check in on trends. And he said, I saw the job posting that sounds exactly like you. And he forwarded me the role. And apparently this role had been open for 2.5 years because they needed someone who had deep startup experience and early stage, was based in the Bay Area. And they wanted someone who had, strangely enough, had Big Four experience. So I did my undergrad at UCLA. So I love UCLA. And back in those days, I worked in the first.com. And I paid my way through college with various dot-com roles. And I thought I'd be a dot-com gazillionaire like everybody else. And all of a sudden in 2002, the dot-com failed. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what am I going to do? And I became an auditor of failed tech companies, which was which was a whole other set of fun. And so I did that for a number of years and I took various entrepreneurial roles around the globe. I'd had a really global career before moving back to San Francisco and starting my company in 2010. And so I was this rare unicorn for EY that had all this Big Four experience and also had a depth of startup experience and actually had a lot of credibility around being a futurist and spotting trends early on.
That is amazing. So do you have any tips for folks on the show? What's the next Uber? What are you seeing?
What's the next Uber? Okay. There's a company called Airtable, and I bet you a lot of companies listening to this and a lot of startups are already using Airtable. Google, Excel, macros on steroids. But the best thing about Airtable is how collaborative it is and how mobile it is. So it lets you truly take databases anywhere and manipulate them and make it for what you want. And I've already seen a number of different. So one of my beliefs around companies that grow is the ecosystem they create around that. And you can look at that with Google, right? So Google was yet another search company, but because the ad marketplace that they developed was better than anything else, they've grown exponentially. They built a business model that scaled and enabled value opportunities for a host of other services. And we can look at the whole ecosystem that ad tech has created around Google and just think about how big that is. Airtable does the same thing. I'm already seeing a lot of entrepreneurs creating new businesses or thinking about new businesses that sit on top of Airtable. And it's replacing a lot of other cost centers for big companies that are using it and loving it. And it's so user-friendly that a lot of the poets, you know, us creative people can still use it and feel that we're pretty tech, data-oriented.
So it's a next generation Excel?
Yeah, in a way, a next generation Excel and really giving us the power of all the macros for those of us who don't know how to write the code.
Right. Amazing. Yeah, because I think, you know, kind of building on your thoughts around the Google ecosystem, right? You had Google comes out and you have a whole industry around how companies and agencies helping brands write better ad copy and helping brands spend their money more efficiently on Google. And advertisers like one by one getting into it, and like all of a sudden you sort of had this huge movement. So what are for AirPlay? What are you you're already seeing companies built on top of that? Is there anything interesting you're seeing right now? And really, you know, even more broadly, it's almost like what can a startup founder learn from what you're seeing, either specific to AirPlay or about like creating community and creating services on top of your business?
So I even think it's broader than community, because community for me, I guess the word has always connotated a person-to-person connection. Mm-hmm. But in these companies, it's an ecosystem. It's not just people to people. It's platform to platform. Mm-hmm. That's why I think companies with open APIs are allowing you to harvest data succeed in the market because of all the interesting things you can do together. Because a lot, your interests are aligned overall. As a marketplace. And yes, you may have competition among one another, but as a, you know, rising tide raises all boats, to use a euphemism. And so I always look, if you're an entrepreneur, does solving the problem you solve create an ecosystem, or does it allow you to be part of a flourishing ecosystem, right? Mm. And it might be something, I think we see a lot of this with the blockchain and ICO and crypto craze, right? Mm-hmm. There's more and more people who are building towards that, who see success in that. And once you have critical mass of sorts, you can't fail, mm-hmm. right? In a way.
So in blockchain and ICOs, there are things you're seeing there? Because to me, it feels like there's the fundamental blockchain technology is transformative in every industry, anywhere where trust is needed, that seems formative. And you sort of have these ICOs and a lot of like market fluctuations and a lot of speculation and a lot of stuff that's happening too, that's like not above board necessarily.
Right.
And so there's a lot of fear in the market as well. But what are you seeing? I mean, that's my like quick take, right? But right. What do you see?
So in technology, I have the criteria of three deaths. The technology has to die three deaths before it really catches hold, right? So let's make an analogy with AI. AI had a huge craze in the 1950s, right? You can look at the number of students who were being educated in the 50s and 60s to follow artificial intelligence. And that died down. But what that did was create bigger systems, better monitors, and a lot of people who were really excited about computers and their potential. And then we had another AI craze in the 80s, and that died down too. But
by Hal?
Yeah, totally. They're like, I need to create a sentient psychopathic computer.
Yes. No.
but
that's 2001 Space Odyssey.
Exactly.
For those who don't know the reference.
The reference. Thanks, Brian. So one of the tangible AI anecdote I've learned being part of EY. So in auditing, we have a platform called Edgar. So Edgar is where any SEC filing happens for public companies. Mm. And I got this anecdote talking to a professor emeritus of accounting who was part of Accenture's, or then Anderson Consulting's, AI practice in the 80s and 90s. So the SEC used to take all the company filings and they'd be physical paper filings, and they'd pile them around their office because they had to keep 7 years. And the pilings got so high, they reached the ceilings, and they were moving in towards the desks. And so they literally had no more space in the office, which forced them to create a technical solution so they didn't have to use physical space. Mm. And that was because of Anderson Consulting's AI research that later on became Edgar. So these things do have a staying power, but they don't stay in that form. And now we're on our third kind of revolution around AI. There was a little blip in the 90s, but nothing really happened. And that's why I think AI is really exciting right now. With blockchain and crypto and ICOs, it's the first. It doesn't mean that there isn't money there. It doesn't mean that technology won't be used, but it's inevitably going to die before it gets resurrected as something tangible that we see in the day to day.
Interesting. So one kind of specific example that comes to mind around both Gen Z and sometimes a lack of awareness of AI that's already present, right, is you take kind of the influencer space where people are creating content on YouTube or on Instagram, and there's an algorithm that determines basically how likely they are to get seen, and that's driving a lot of the likes or comments or that sort of behavior. And this is a place I know a lot about, so I see this a lot, right? But you'll have certain influencers who don't realize that they are at the mercy of that algorithm.
Right.
And so like they think that they're creating content that's really awesome and that they're a superstar, and then the algorithm switches and all of a sudden they go from like, you know, 100,000 views every time they post to 10,000 views every time they post. And they haven't realized that the last 2 years they've basically been working under an algorithm, and that algorithm can change at any point in time. And like they're upset about that. and it's just like, I don't know where we go with that, but it's an interesting case of like people who are digitally native who also aren't fully understanding the extent that AI is driving the experience that they have digitally or that their friends have digitally.
Yeah, so one, I think it's important that like people in a system aren't taking the step back to think critically about what system they're in.
Yes.
Whether you're a YouTube influencer, an Instagram influencer, if you are reliant on a digital network, you are subject to that digital network's whims.
Rules. And whims.
Yeah.
Rules and whims.
I think, okay, I mean, here's a personal anecdote for me. Everybody calls my Facebook feed the nerd feed. I mean, you can tell. All I do is share thought-provoking pieces from my research. And I've tracked for my own personal, you know, knowledge, what's my data on links. And I've seen over the past 3 years, the personal engagement with my personal page fall dramatically. And of course, then you can research it and look at it. Like Facebook has changed the algorithm, so ads get seen more than your personal page. If you're not sharing photos, things go down dramatically. Like you can do the work, but it is hard to think about, okay, how is this going to change, right? And I think something I've seen in Gen Z is that they're comfortable just letting something go and starting anew, right?
Yeah.
Like they're like, okay, everything's fluid and everything's like, you know, like, oh, I was a YouTube influencer yesterday. I'm not an influencer today. Tomorrow, I'm going to go be a star in Hollywood, or I'm going to become a VC. Like, you know, they're not as attached to that title or narrative. And you can even think about that with jobs, right? The average time that millennials spend in jobs, not just Gen Z, we haven't really seen enough of them, is 1 year and 9 months.
Yeah.
You know, and that's unheard of to folks that I work with. I can't believe I work with people who have 35 years of tenure in the same company.
I know.
It's mind blowing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I can believe that. I think at my 5-year reunion at business school, I'd worked in 3 jobs already. and there were people who were like the same job for 5 years. I'm looking at them like, that's nuts. And they're looking at me like, you've had 3 jobs? Like, what's wrong with you?
And right. And I think that's something that tech enables, right?
Mm.
Like we're playing we're playing with illusions a lot.
Mm. Like, tell me more about that.
I wish I had my phone nearby. Like your phone is a magical tool, right? Like you are connected. You are connected to the entire world
instantly
through a glowing rectangle that sits in your palm.
Yes.
You know, and if you create illusions, you're more aware of the ephemerality of them, right? So those of us who work in tech and build tech, you know, I, for better or for worse, I'm not passing a judgment on it, but we are more comfortable with change because we are so driven towards change. Yeah. I just had a great meeting with a friend who's a 10-year veteran at Hulu. So again, talk about longevity, but her role at Hulu has changed dramatically in the 10 years. Like she's had to grow, in a way, she's had a different job every year
like
and a half.
2 or 3 years,
And that's the beauty of a growing tech company. And yet, because we know everything is an illusion, we're so dedicated to measuring them. Right? So they're more tangible. We know how we've grown. We know how we change. We know what's different day over day. And I think that that measurement allows us to create better because we're always striving. We're always creating that friction with our tools to have better tools.
Right.
To have better illusions.
So is Magic Leap part of, do you check out Magic Leap?
I have, like the whole AR, VR trend, augmented reality. I mean, I think reality is trippy enough. So
augmenting it and
I mean, to share on this podcast, and you and I have talked about this a lot. So in 2012 I had a traumatic brain injury and having a TBI dramatically changed how I process the world. You know, it gave me
TBI is traumatic brain injury.
TBI stands shorthand for traumatic brain injury. And one, it made me a very mindful of my tech diet because I couldn't look at a screen for more than 2 hours a day.
Mm.
So I meant no phone, no TV, no laptop, no working. So I got to be very aware of my use in relationship to technology. And the other part of that is it had me understand that environments change all the time. So I think I now have hyper awareness. Like this room is so gorgeous and like, this room is covered in brocades and lamps and it's wonderfully lit and I'm just enjoying this.
Yeah. So it's a special space.
Right. It's a very special space. So with augmented reality, if you gave me some glasses that would make an elephant appear in the middle of this room, I think that was cool, but I love the room as it is. So right. I don't need an elephant in the middle of it.
Right.
But it just because I don't like it for myself doesn't mean that it doesn't have applicabilities or interest. And I've got to experience some leading edge VR with haptics. So you're feeling the experience that you're in.
Uh-huh.
And I love that. It's such a trip. And a lot of people I know who are immersed in those VR worlds and VR games, it is another alteration of your brain, of the way you process the world. So the same way that we love movies and other immersive experiences and other novel experiences, it has VR and AR has the same appeal.
Just more of that. Yeah. So what are other big technology trends you're seeing or that you're educating? Most of your work at EY is internal and educating, like helping the company better understand trends that they should be aware of and that their clients should be aware of?
Absolutely. So my role at EY is helping them understand emerging technologies and how the startup ecosystem and the way that they work is going to change the nature of work for us all, whether that's the tools we use or the expectations people have of a working environment, and kind of keeping abreast and taking insights from that world and translating them into what does it look like for a 250,000 global enterprise.
Yeah.
So a lot of tech I look at is, of course, B2B, or at least those within applications. But since I'm looking broadly at what trends are what human beings want to experience, right?
Mm.
Like it's where we're evolving together and tech is just a tool like anything else that we're using to achieve the experience we're chasing after. So I look broader at that level and then try to translate it into the practical. And I do publish internally a weekly digest around what insights have emerged and kind of takeaways and help our teams have better conversations with their clients and internally.
Yeah. So is there anything you can share from some of those recent like weekly memos?
Yeah. So last week's memo, I talked about the weaponization of AI.
Mm.
So we've been listening a lot to the fake news debacle and there's a debate raging internally within tech that is the ability to manipulate truth a weapon? And how, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Ian Goodfellow was interviewed for MIT Press recently, and he said, it's not technology's responsibility to do that. It's on us to distinguish fact from fiction, to better equip young people to learn.
I'm giving a big smirk at that.
and he's shaking his head vigorously.
Yeah.
Versus another company that just was launched out of Y Combinator called Swayable is full of a lot of political scientists and media specialists who are building an app that can actually help you tell fact from fiction and help you tell how persuasive a piece of technology is.
Mm-hmm.
So again, a tool for both sides, nonpartisan tool in a way.
Right, right. So this idea of reality versus non-reality, fake news, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's been recent in the news, and sometimes you see technical revolution happen in porn first. and
so true. The internet was for porn.
The internet was right. And AR VR might be one of the leading applications to start out. But one of the things that, I've read about, you know, haven't seen, I'm not really sure about this stuff, but, they basically had someone developed a technology where you could put someone's face on someone else's body in a porn movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could take like there's one actress, but then Jennifer Lawrence's face gets put on that person.
Mm-hmm.
And at first that took a while to do. And then suddenly there was some leap in the technology and it was basically like you press a button, it compiles in an hour and you could like turn any moving image into someone fake or not someone fake, but basically put another person into that scene.
Yep.
And when you think about that, in politics, right? Like, so that technology is there. There was a lot of controversy. I think Reddit actually pulled down that, and there's some way they need to develop technology to identify when that's happening, so you can pull it out. Because you can think about someone's reputation, right? That could be forever damaged potentially with that type of experience. And then you put that into, you know, kind of a political realm, and you could put, you know, Donald Trump's face on someone else's thing and have him say something, and then that looks like truth. And you know, to the person who said, well, that's the people's job to determine, not technology's job. Like that's why I was shaking my head so vigorously, is like, you have technology that like that exists right now. And it's only going to get more, like that capability is only going to increase and be applied, you know, outside of porn, but in all these other places,
right,
where the idea of distinguishing truth versus fiction is one thing when it's like written. But if you can do that in video and in a video type of experience, like fake someone saying something that's they're actually never said, those implications seem massive. And what does our society look like if we don't know what's truth and like what's real and what's not?
That is what keeps me up at night. It's true. I mean, because that undermines societal stability.
Yeah.
Right? If you, like, we are in trust. We are in trust that the organizations out there. We are in trust that if I buy a house, the deed to my house is managed by my city government, not by a blockchain that comes and decides that, oh, I like this house, I'm going to own it, and I'm able to blockchain to own your house, which actually could exist right now,
right,
technically.
Yeah.
We rely on the trust of the systems that we have, one system being media. Right.
Yeah.
That what we see on the news is true. I remember, so my step grandfather is a 90-year-old World War II veteran who loves Fox News. And I remember him sitting there on Fox News watching one segment talk about how a young Mexican immigrant is a hero. And then 30 minutes later, you've got Tucker Carlson calling like Mexican immigrants demons and, you know, vagrant, like horrible terrorists.
Yeah.
And he's like, which is true. They just said something else differently. But for him, it's indistinguishable.
Yeah.
So for all of us, we are overloaded with information. And there's such a tendency to look at technology, to look at the filters we have set up on Facebook, to look at the lists we have created for ourselves on Twitter, to even look at who we trust to go for information person to person.
Yeah.
Right? We are looking for that trust. And tech in that way undermines it. Right?
Yeah.
But to whom do we have to be accountable and why? So one of the major trends I've been covering is technoethics.
Mm.
How do we have these conversations and who's the arbiter of deciding that? Right? Like who is the governing body for technology right now? We are. Those who create it.
Yeah.
But there is no, you know, government technology board. We have a little bit of it with some of the FCC rulings, but overall, we're the ones informing how tech should work. We're the ones hitting those algorithms and rewarding ourselves like hamsters for whatever, some bad things to happen.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you see, like, the legislative framework for a lot of this is years behind, decades behind where the technology is.
Absolutely.
And that, I see some of that. I think that's really scary trends because I'm not sure our legislators are informed about the true issues. And so sometimes you have just technology like race way out in front of it. And then legislation tries to catch up, but maybe it's misinformed or it's built around financial considerations rather than societal considerations. Mm-hmm. Is there anything, and you've spent some time in DC as well?
Only my fiance is from DC. I don't think that counts as government time.
Okay.
Yeah.
But do you see, is there anything changing on the legislative front that would help with some of these trends? I mean, you considering autonomous vehicles, right? If we take something specific where basically the technology for that is if it's not ready now, it's ready within 12 months.
So what I see that is encouraging is actually like the think tanks and lobbying organizations that arise around technology, right? Mm-hmm. You've got a lot of really smart people who are technologists who were working for the administrations over the past 12 years and former presidents, thinking about what technology needs to look like in the future and having an active role, whether they did stints through the USCTO or worked under the Obama administration or worked under the Bush administration. They're coming back into tech and then taking a point of view and coming back out. So right now, you know, it's more of a point of view that we kind of have to do it ourselves, that I don't know that government is going to catch up anytime soon. And I think that we have to push on them what that is. And I think we're seeing that not just in technology, but more widely in society, which is interesting because that's actually an evolution I'm curious about. There's another big trend right now of creating technology that helps solve some of the government's problems. It acts as an intermediary between people and the governing bodies that be, whether that's something as easy as collecting property taxes or, you know, lobbying for where you want to be. And you do have more and more folks in tech looking at the spaces that government has neglected and trying to build opportunities, cultures, and products that serve people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like technology is inherently for the people. It's we can create it.
Right.
So.
An optimistic view. I'm happy on a Friday.
I always try to take an optimistic view because it's too easy to say it's all doom and gloom. I mean, every scenario can be a doomsday, we're left in a desolate wilderness with nothing and our iPhones don't even work, right? We're staring at the last bar as the photo of our loved ones disappear.
Right.
You know, that's too, like, but yet, I like to think about a future where we're more closely aligned technology and biology. That's another tech trend I'm looking at, right? I mean, we're already so addicted to our phones, but what happens when technology is embedded in who we are? Think about Beyond Pacemaker. I do like shows like Black Mirror, even if they are heartbreaking, because I think by understanding the dark side of what we create, we can create more light.
Love that. Yeah. You can't just only look at the light. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'd love to switch gears a little bit and go into a little bit more on startups. So you had your own consulting practice helping startups get to sale. For the entrepreneurs who listen to this show, are there a couple of lessons that you've seen or things that, you've experienced that could be helpful for people who, one of the things, like when you're starting a company, the question of like, where do you exit is certainly there, but usually a lot of the energy in the early days is like, how do you just get a product? How do you get live? How do you get people using it?
Right.
And that is very different than who do we sell it to? Why do they want to buy us? What would a acquiring company actually value in this business? Curious about your thoughts there.
Because you've had a lot of experience at the very beginning?
Yeah. Or, because your experience was more in terms of getting companies ready to sell.
Well, right? I worked from five people startups to 400 person startups. Yeah. So it was kind of the whole gamut. In the early stages, I think it's really important for the founding team to understand what it is that they're best at, right? It's the 80-20 rule. What is it that you can do that no one else can do? And yes, you're going to have to, you know, mop floors and do taxes and do a lot of stuff that maybe you're not great at. But 80% of your time needs to be built on the thing that you're trying to achieve in the way that only you can achieve it.
Mm-hmm.
And the people I knew who were the most successful, who scaled the most quickly, did that time and time again. They only made decisions on the stuff that they were great at. And the ones that, like, whether that was the product guy who knew what great product looked like. So he made all the design decisions and he made all the engineering hires because he knew ultimately what the product was. And everything else, marketing and PR, business development, outsourced to really smart people he could hire. I knew a female founder who was so fierce and knew her voice, and everything was about trying to find the path towards her voice and sharing that more broadly. And that was really her critical ingredient to success, was having that outward voice and that outward communication. So I think we're all blessed with things that only we can do. And I think having people around us who can say, what's your superpower, and allow us to focus on that time and again.
Yeah.
I think that's the most critical ingredient for early stage founders. And that, and the other thing is healthy mental practices. I swear to God. I thought there was a Quora post I read years ago, and I'm so sad I lost it. But it was like, what are five things founders need to succeed? And it was a ritualized exercise practice, a therapist, a dog, because the dog's going to be the only one who loves them at the end of the day.
No matter what.
Right, no matter what. Close friends that they stay in contact with. And it was like, overall healthy emotional habits, healthy self-talk, meditation was number five. So
I feel good. I've got most of those in place.
You're a good entrepreneur and you're a good person.
No, I do. That's actually been a part of my evolution as an entrepreneur, is like every day meditation in the morning, quick journaling practice. I use Allswell notebooks for that. amazing. Laura Rubin's the founder of that company. And then like frequent exercise, right? And that's that activity for me is what helps me be more present with what's happening as the day comes on, and more focused to say, like, because as a startup too, you get like, you know, 200 things are happening every single day, and there might be 20 that you can get done.
Right.
And there might be 25 that you need to get done. Right. But how do you stay in the moment with that, of saying, okay, this thing is like, that can go away, that can fall away, that doesn't need to necessarily happen, and like shedding all that stuff out, so that the stuff that absolutely needs to happen and kind of hits to your superpower, you can have the time and space to do that.
Exactly. And on your note, I think one of the things we miss in modern life is ritual, right?
Yeah.
We're not conditioned. And there's something, no matter what your ritual is, if it's meditation, journaling, having a cup of coffee and doodling in the morning, we're hardwired for spirituality.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I think that's one of the reasons we're so enchanted by tech.
Yeah.
But having those rituals help ground you to a purpose greater than yourself and an experience greater than yourself, and helps you get out of that day to day of, inbox zero, oh, I got to build my product, product's behind, like all of the worries that pass around. So,
yeah, I love it. So, Jen, where can people find you?
I love if everyone finds me on LinkedIn. I put everything on LinkedIn, and I'm always happy to have a chat on Twitter. But just say hi. I'm friendly.
What's your Twitter handle?
At Jennifer J. Hirsch.
At Jennifer J. Hirsch. Awesome. Well, Jen, it's been absolutely fantastic to have you on the show.
Brian, it's been a ton of fun.
Yeah. And I'm curious. I want to have you back down and tell us about the technology trends again in like 6 or 9 months, because it is changing so fast.
It is.
It'll be different.
I mean, every year I've got a whole new list. Only two things made it on from my 9 last year.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Which is part of the excitement, right?
It is.
Changes that fast.
It is.
Well, this has been a wonderful episode. I'm Brian Nickerson. I've been guest hosting for Esprit Devora. And this has been Jen Hirsch. And thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
Yes, you can now get your We Are LA Tech tee. You've all been asking for it. Just go to wearelatech.com/shop to be a part of the movement to make Los Angeles the top city in the world for tech. Yes, we are number 3. Let's get it to number 1. Wearelatech.com/shop. Represent.
Hi, everyone. My name is Brian Nickerson. I'm co-founder of Magic Links, and I am guest hosting for Esprit Devora on Women in Tech.